in the class at all, the book gets its name from what does the name Deuteronomy mean? If you take the dute part and change it into duet, what do you get out of that? How many? Two, and nomos is a Greek word. So what you've got is deuteros nomos is what you've got. And just for make it sound good, it's Deuteronomy, and nomos means what? What would be your guess? No. Close. Second what? Second law. Because it's the second law, and it's given that book because it's the second time the Ten Commandments are found. Now, where are they found the first time? Exodus, Moses leads them out of the land of Egypt. They come down to Mount Sinai, and there the Ten Commandments are given there at Mount Sinai. Now then, Deuteronomy is written, and the historical aspect of Deuteronomy is not concurrent. It's not at the time when they're at Mount Sinai. How old is Moses when this book is written? All right, specifically, 119 years, 364 days. Is that right, Don? Don showed me something in this book that I had never seen. Look in the last, where is that? It's on the left-hand side of the page. Chapter 32, verse 48. Look at chapter 32, verse 48. This to me is really interesting. When's this book written? Well, we've just been reading in the other classroom this Song of Moses found in Deuteronomy chapter 32. And when you get to the end of that, like verse 44, Moses came with Joshua the son of Nun and spoke all the words of this song in the hearing of the people. Moses finished speaking all these words to Israel. Now look at verse 48. Then the Lord spoke to Moses that very same day, go up to Mount Nebo and die. So if he died at 120, and that's really being facetious, about 119, 364 days, or what, or 365 days, or whatever it was. How many years beyond 120 he lived. But this is the last day of Moses' life. Now, in the other class, we've been talking about it's the last month. Look back in Deuteronomy chapter 1. Deuteronomy chapter 1 says in verse 3, in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month. And so that gets us, to the period of time that if Moses at that age, and you take his life divided into three 40-year periods of time, you're right at the end of Moses' life. And it evidently is indicative of the fact this book was written the very last day that he died. Now, somebody asked a Sunday night question. Look back to the last chapter of this and ask the question that said, if Moses wrote this book, how could he write about his death? Anybody want to comment about that? If Moses is the author of the book of Deuteronomy, how could he write the details of his death? God told him what to write. Just like Jesus could foretell his death and tell about he was going to be, in 3 days he'd be raised again. It's easy for God to see the history, and so if you knew if God had told you how you were going to die, you could write that before you died also. What about that statement that Moses was the meekest man on this earth? How could a man say that and still be meek? Well, what if it's true? God told him what to write, and that's a good answer in relationship to both of it. But I've heard some people say, well, how on earth could a man say he was the meekest man on the earth? Would that make him not meek? Well, you wouldn't want to make him a liar, would you? If the Holy Spirit is the author of this book, and that's really the point that we're trying to make. Now then, the next time you read the book of Deuteronomy, I want you to read it with this in mind. Moses is talking to a generation of young people in relationship to his age. Moses is 120 years of age. Now then, with the exception of two that we know by name, how old is the next oldest person in that nation? 59 and 60, and I think both of those are are good answers. Now, how do you get at that? Well, how many of those who left the land of Egypt came into the promised land? How many of those above 20 years of age entered into the promised land? Two. Their names? Joshua and Caleb. So everybody that was above 20 years of age died in the wilderness. How long have they been in the wilderness? 40 years. And so the next oldest person in that congregation is half Moses' age. That's a remarkable concept. Now then, the thing we've been emphasizing in the other classroom is these are second generation Christians, and put that in quotation marks. I mean, their parents saw the power of God there in the land of Egypt, and they've been in the very presence of God. Now Judaism has started. Now you've got a formal religion, and almost every one of them has grown up in that religion. I mean, if you're 10 years of age whenever you leave the land of Egypt, and now you're 50 years of age, you've been, and put this in quotation, you've been a Christian for 50 years. He's a second generation. They're second generation people who believe in God. And so the question that is to be considered as you read this book, if you could talk to our young people in this congregation, if those of you who are 40 years or above, twice the age of those who are in their 20s, if you could say something to them, what would you say? That's the background of this book. And so here's Moses, aged compared to everybody else there. I mean, in this 40th year, Aaron died. In this 40th year, Miriam has died. And so they've got one old man, and then Joshua and Caleb. Caleb is what? 85 years of age when they got over to the promised land. So we don't know how old Joshua was, but I mean, Moses is nearly 40 years older than Caleb. So, you stop and think about, here's an old man. If you could say something to your grandchildren, what would you say? That's what this book is all about. Now, to emphasize the importance of this book, every time Jesus was tempted, he quoted the Bible. When the Lord said, or when the Satan said, turn these stones into bread, what did Jesus say? It is written, man shall not live by bread alone. Would you like to guess what book in the Bible that comes from? That's, if you've been listening, I bet you could almost guess, right? It's from Deuteronomy. Whenever the Lord, Satan says to Jesus, I'll get this straight in a minute. When Satan says to Jesus, fall down and worship me and I'll give you all the kingdoms of this world, Jesus says, it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God and him only shalt thou serve. Would you like to guess what book that comes from? When the Satan says to Jesus, fall off this temple, and Jesus says, it is written, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. Would you like to guess what book that comes from? The book of Deuteronomy is a book about life. And sometimes I think we fail to see that, and especially those who are second-generation Christians. Second-generation Christians can easily make the mistake of becoming like Pharisees in the first century. The Pharisees in the first century knew the law of God. They knew about every feast day. They knew about all of the sacrifices. They knew more than God did about the Sabbath. You think about that for a moment? God had given them the Sabbath, and then they had superimposed on the Sabbath their own commandments, like that Sabbath day's journey. That's not in the Old Testament at all. And they'd made all of these laws. And so when Jesus cures the man on the Sabbath day, he's sinned. Why? You've been working, practicing medicine on the Sabbath day. They had superimposed their laws onto the laws of God. And the things that we've said as we've studied this book is, the Pharisees knew the book of Leviticus. The book of Leviticus is the one that has all the sacrifices in it. You think about the name Leviticus. Levites were the priests. And they knew that Old Testament law down to the nth degree. They had made their own laws and superimposed their own laws on top of that. You know, remember Corban? Jesus said, the Bible had said, thou shalt honor thy father and thy mother, and you say to your parents, Corban. What does that mean? It's been given to God. Mom and Dad, I wish I could have helped you, but I cannot help you because I gave it down at the temple. Do you know the law of Corban is not over there in the Old Testament at all? They'd taken one of the commandments of God and superimposed their own law on top of it. And they had stopped studying the Bible when they got through the book of Leviticus. Now, those of you who've grown up in the church, listen to me. It is important to know the laws of God and what God says. But it is foolish to know the laws of God without knowing God. Now, I want to say that again. It's important to know the laws of God. But it is folly to know the laws of God without knowing God who gives those laws. And so when you study the Bible, when you sit in Bible classes, when you listen to sermons, you need to learn about the nature of the God there is behind those laws. And they had missed it. They had totally missed it. They knew what Judaism taught. You know, there are people who know the five acts of worship who never worship. Think about that. People who can say, the bread is his body and the fruit of the vine is his blood. And they never have communion with God. You think about those Pharisees in the first century. Did they pray? Well, they said prayers. There's a difference in saying prayers and praying. There's a real difference in that. When they prayed, they used long prayers with empty repetitions. And they prayed to be seen to me. Did they fast? Oh, absolutely. In fact, they disfigured their faces so everybody would know they were fasting. Totally missed what fasting was all about. And that's why the book of Deuteronomy is so important. And I'd encourage you, those of you who've not... I'd encourage every one of you, but especially those of you who've not been in the class, as we've studied the book of Deuteronomy, to sit down and to read these things with that in mind. Because in this passage, in this book, is found the greatest commandment that God ever gave. Isn't that amazing? When they came to Jesus and said, "What is the first and greatest commandment?" I suspect they were thinking Exodus. But Jesus doesn't quote Exodus. He says the greatest commandment is to do what? Love God with what? All of your heart, all of your soul, all of your mind, and all of your strength. Now that's the most important thing God ever said. Now then, those who've been in the class know that we found that verse that says you are to serve Him with all of your heart and with all of your mind. You know, I cannot be half-hearted in the kind of service that I give God. And the reflection and the manifestation of the love that I have for God is whether or not I serve God and the kind of service I give to God. And that's critical for us to look at. We've talked about this in the other class, but I want us to spend some time looking in chapter 19 today. With all of that other is just sort of an introduction. But in chapter 19, There is the account of the cities of refuge. And then there are some of those things that are really, really practical in relationship to some of these things. But in verse 1, he talks about when the Lord your God has cut off the nations, which the Lord your God is giving you. Now, I want you to stop and think about the wording of this. When they went into the promised land, what would have been their tendency once they got into the promised land about we've got this land? Would not their tendency have been to say, we've got this land? Look what we've done. Now, when they go into the promised land and they capture Jericho, how much selfish pride can they take about having captured that city? How many times they walk around that city? 7? 13? Let's add it up. They marched around the city for 6 days. How many times for the first 6 days did they march around the city? One time a day. On the 7th day, they marched around the city how many times? 7 times. Now, what happened when they were marching around the city? Well, there's the Ark of the Covenant. And marching behind that Ark of the Covenant is the Jewish nation. I've tried in my mind to even envision what that would be like. You think of the millions of people that were there, and I don't know if the children went to that or not, but I've tried in my mind to envision what that was like. And they march without saying a word. Now, can you imagine that? I think they must have left the preachers and the women back home. I hope you know I'm joking. I want to get out of this place alive, okay? But now you imagine marching around that city. And when they walk, I love to think about the guard, the watchman on the walls of that city. Here they come. Well, they have their weapons drawn. No, they've got some golden box out in front of them. Or, well, he doesn't know that there's a golden box. They've got this, they're a group of men carrying something on their shoulders, got a blue cloth over it. That's the Ark of the Covenant. And they march around that city, and then they go back home. Now here are the guys, here's the king, the governor of the city down inside of the city. What's going on? What's happening up there? All the people saying, what's happening up there? And nothing's happened. And the second day, you've got the exact same thing, and day three and four and five and six. And day seven, they don't go back home. They keep marching, and then they go around the city seven times. Then they blow the trumpets, and the people shout, and the walls fall down. Now, how much can they brag about what we have done? That's amazing. That is amazing. Now here's an interesting question. As far as the record goes, how many Jews died conquering the promised land? Well, I don't know is a good answer. But the Bible tells us. Now I'm just saying as far as the record goes, there were many battles, but there's one battle where the number that were killed is given. The battle at Ai, there were 36 Jews killed. That's another story in and of itself, but you stop and think about the fact that when they conquered that land, nobody's died. As far as the record goes, how much can they say, look what we've done? And yet the very nature of ourselves is to take credit for what the providence of God has provided for us. You got a nice car? Yeah, I worked hard. You know, I've worked a lot of hours to get that. Got a good house? Yeah, I really worked hard to get that. Well, you're in reality no different from the way these people are, because the Lord gave them houses like He's given you a house. But look in verse 1 where He says, the Lord your God has cut off the nations out of the land. And the Lord your God is giving you. And you dispossess and dwell in their cities and in their houses. Separate three cities for yourselves. Now how has the Lord, what did the Lord give, how did the Lord assist them in another way in capturing that land? Now you have to read my mind. But before they ever got into the promised land, the Lord did something to the people that were there. They what? They feared them? Now, you know more than that? What if I say an insect? Hornets. Before they ever got in the promised land, the Lord sent hornets in there to discomfort the people and to build the fear of God. Now, I want you to stop and think about the fear of God. Here they are, and they've left Mount Sinai. How do they know when to move? What tells them to move? There's that cloud that was there, and it starts moving. What about at night? It's a pillar of fire. Now, I want you to imagine those Canaanite nations sending their spies out down into the wilderness. Now, they know about the things that are happening there because Rahab, who's in the city of Jericho, Rahab knows all about it. Now, I want you to imagine those Canaanite nations when they send their spies down there to see this massive group of people that's coming. Now they come, and in reality, even before Moses dies, the east side of the Jordan River Moses is alive when they capture that. Now over on the west side of the Jordan River, between the Jordan and the Mediterranean seas, where all of these Canaanite nations are, and they send spies over there. Now imagine what report those spies would come back with. We waited till midnight to sneak up on them to find out what was going on. And we got over there and they had a street like you wouldn't believe. They had this pillar of fire that was there. Would that put fear in your heart? I mean, you stop and think about everything that's happened. Rahab knew about, look over in the book of Joshua. Look at all that Rahab knew in the book of Joshua. And I suppose, where is that? Yes, chapter 2, Joshua chapter 2, verse 9. Now, if she is expressing what is believed in the city of Jericho, and if what is believed in the city of Jericho is what's believed by the nations that are there, she says, I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites, that's on the east bank of the Jordan, who were on the other side, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted, neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now, if that's what's being believed by those Canaanite nations that are there. And now, they go into that promised land. How on earth could anybody ever get puffed up and say, look what I've done. Look what I've done. Let's go back to Jericho one moment. Did all of the walls of Jericho fall down? Every place except one house that was right there at the wall. And that's where Rahab was. Her house was on or adjoined the wall. I believe the text says on the wall. And that part of the wall did not fall down. That's remarkable. Now you think about being inside the city of Jericho. Think about what you've seen in China. And those things that are on the internet about China and on the news. And about there's the earthquake that is there. Imagine in that city, the walls fall down. We have heard that the Lord is with you. I want you to stop and think about the blessing of having the Lord with you. The eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and His ears are open to their prayers, but the face of the Lord is what? It's against those who are evil. They're just the two sides. I want you to stop and think about the blessing of having the Lord with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. He's faithful who's promised that. Therefore, we will not fear what man shall do to us. That's Hebrews 13. I want you to think about the problems that you're having in your life right this very minute. And just imagine trying to face those problems without God. I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you walk through the valley of the shadow of death without a knowledge of the fact that God is with me. man. He is either with me or his face is against me. And that's why we need to not get all puffed up about what we have done. When you offer thanks, don't you say a prayer. You be thankful. That's the whole problem with this second generation Christian Jews. The danger of not being thankful. The Pharisee and the publican that went into the temple to pray. You remember the prayer? I fast. I give alms. And then he was thankful. I'm thankful what? I'm thankful that I'm not like this publican. In a congregation, a preacher preached about this very thing. And in the closing prayer, the guy who led the prayer says, Father, we're thankful that we're not like this Pharisee. I don't think the guy got the whole point of the sermon. But you just think of how easy it is not to be thankful. But what you have is because of the goodness of God. Now then, back to chapter 19. We're not even going to get to where I want to go. Separate three cities in the midst of your land which the Lord your God has given you to possess. Prepare roads for yourself and divide into three parts the territory of your land which the Lord your God has given you to inherit, that any manslayer may flee there. This is Deuteronomy 19, verse 4. And this is the cause of the manslayer who flees there, that he may live. Whoever kills his neighbor unintentionally, not having hated him in times past, as when a man goes to the woods with his neighbors to cut timber, and his hand swings a stroke with the axe to cut down the tree, and the head slips from the handle and strikes the neighbor so that he dies, he shall flee to one of the cities and live. Lest the avenger of blood, while his anger is hot, pursue the manslayer and overtake him, because the way is long, and kill him, though he's not deserving of death, since he had not hated the victim in the past. Therefore I command you, saying, separate these three cities. God is fair. And that law, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, was a civil law. A life for a life was a civil law. But you see, there is such a thing as second degree manslaughter. There is such a thing as unintentionally causing somebody's death. And in the justice of the legal system in our land, even our laws recognize this possibility. So here's a man who accidentally killed somebody. The illustration is the axe flies off the head and the man is killed. Well, the law said an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. The avenger has a right to put him to death. But he didn't mean to do it. God made provision for that man who didn't mean to do it. When I talk about knowing God, that's part of what I'm talking about. Does God make a difference in a sin that we're not conscious of and a sin that we intentionally, blatantly spit in the face of God? Does he make a difference? Hebrews 10:25, we know that says, not forsaking the assembling of yourself together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, so much the more as you see the day approaching, because if we sin willfully after we have received the knowledge of the truth, That's intentional. That's that individual who knows what God says and who just goes ahead and does it. That's his heart. It's not a matter of weakness. Every sin is a matter of one's will yielding to whatever is there. But this is that intentional sin that says, I know that's wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway. I don't care what God says. If we sin willfully, after that we've received the knowledge of the truth, there remains no more sacrifice for sin. But a certain fearful and looking for and expectation of the judgment which shall devour the adversary. He that despised Moses died without witnesses, or died without mercy at the mouth of two or three witnesses. Of how much sore a punishment suppose ye shall he be thought worthy of, to paraphrase, who intentionally, blatantly rebels against God. And that's what you're learning here. Here's this man that accidentally does wrong. And God provided a place of refuge for him. Now, God has always been one who provided a place of refuge. Think about the ark. In Noah's day, as a place of refuge. Judgment of God is coming. And there's a place of refuge. God shut the door of that ark. But God shut the door of that ark from the inside. Inside the ark, in the presence of God, was a place of refuge. And the church is a place of refuge. It's a place of refuge in relationship to sin, but it's just a place of refuge whenever we get discouraged. Think of how far some of you have driven today. And a part of this day and the enjoyment of this day is being around your brethren. I don't know if we practice a holy kiss, but this church practices more of the holy hug than any place I've ever been on this earth. I just got back from Michigan and a little old lady walked out and I put my arm around her to hug her, and I learned in a hurry that you don't hug that woman up there in that church. I thought I'd back here in Palm Beach Lakes, you know. But I just love these holy hugs around here. It's a place of refuge. It's going to be all right. My brothers and my sisters are here. And then it's a place of refuge whenever the judgment day comes and it all ends. It's a place of refuge. Read the book of Deuteronomy. But read it as a second generation Christian. Not to learn the laws of God, and you've got the laws of God here, but these cities of refuge has a whole lot more to do with the nature of the God behind the laws than the laws themselves. They knew the laws. I bet you they even had a law about how big the axe head was, how far away the man was standing. I mean, I don't know that, but that's just the way when people who make these lists come at it. But learn the God behind these laws. And then love Him with all of your heart and your soul and your mind and your strength. Thank you very much for listening.